Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Tortoise Shack podcast. A couple of quick things before we kick off. Obviously, part two of our revelations in RTE is out right now on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. But more importantly, this morning we dropped a new podcast with our friend, young journalist Mahmoud Mushtaha, who listeners would have known over the last couple of years, contributed from inside Gaza. He has now gotten out. He is in Cairo and he joined us to talk about the future he wants and the 6 months of the genocidal campaign that he endured. So there's lots of laughter and tears. It was an emotional chat with our friend, filled with happiness and that survivor's guilt that we hear so much about. That's available right now, top of the feed at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It is the price of a fancy cup of coffee to you, but to us it's mics on, lights on, bills paid, and the ability to have conversations like the one you're about to listen to with the fabulous Professor Richard Murphy. He is a listener favourite and he breaks down taxation and why we need to change our thinking in relation to what tax actually is. We're always very grateful for his time, and without further ado, I'll let you go and listen to it. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and we are back talking to one of our favourite guests and our listeners' favourite guest, Professor Richard Murphy has rejoined us. But before he does, I want to let Martin know, just a little treat, Martin. You're not aware of this, but we've been trying to, obviously we're raising funds for people in Gaza for the last next 6 months since this campaign, this horrible genocidal campaign has begun. But one of the things we were doing recently was with these amazing scarves designed by artist Adam Spicebag Doyle. And so we were selling them to raise funds. And Martin, someone sent me a message and said, I've paid for one, but I want you to give it to Martin for the help he gave me on something. So I said, absolute deal, as long as I can choke you with it. It absolutely breaks my heart to see people thinking you're doing good work. You know, it breaks my heart. Speaking of great work, our regular contributor and just on from Bloomberg, no less, Richard. It's taxing times. Let's have a chat about taxing wealth 2024. Give us a little bit of an overview, if you don't mind, because it's something I'm absolutely I'm clued into, and I really think more people should be paying much more attention.
Look, I'm deeply disappointed, Tony, because you told me before we started this, you haven't read the whole of the Taxing Wealth Report 2024.
Richard, it's 120.
So why I'm carrying on with... It's only 126,000 words and 440 pages. What are you moaning about? Look, why did I write something
like
as long as that?
Threads, Tony.
I know. And I don't read them either.
Let's stand back a minute and ask, why did I begin this mad escapade of writing this enormous report that I published on the 5th of April to mark the end of one tax year, the start of a new one? It's basically because I listened to Labour MPs in the UK saying there is no money left. And we all know that the answer to that is absolutely, that claim is absolutely nonsense, because the government makes money. They're the only people who can make money without ending up on the wrong side of a prison wall, for certain. Banks certainly have a license to help, but governments actually have to grant that license as well. So they are the source of all money. To say there's no money left is therefore wrong. But even if they're saying there's no more tax that they can raise, that's also wrong. And so I set out to show that there are vast numbers of ways in which we could raise more tax in the UK if we wished. And the focus was on existing taxes. I didn't want to come up with new and complicated taxes that would take forever to introduce. And I wanted those extra taxes that were I was going to try and collect to come from the top 10% of income and wealth earners in the UK, because I did some background work that showed that they're seriously undertaxed at present. And therefore, even after everything I've recommended, they would still remain undertaxed compared to the average taxpayer in the UK when taking into consideration their total income and capital gains. And we're talking averages here, and I accept that because, of course, there are going to be exceptions to every rule. But on average, they're undertaxed. And I wanted to show that, therefore, this point that there's nothing we can do because there is no money to raise is nonsense. And that's what I think succeeded in doing. I've shown that there's 92 billion.
I was going to say, like the headline figure, Richard, it's I was going to say Monopoly money, but it's much more than, you know, it's a lot more than you can get your head around. And yet you're saying it's almost, I'm going to use a phrase that's probably unfair, it's almost low-hanging fruit.
Literally, some of these are totally low-hanging fruit, yeah. I mean, some of them are so simple to do that they could be done with very little time expended, very little effort in legislative terms, easy to deliver. And the one of the reasons for offering 30 recommendations and further reforms to tax incentivized savings, which, by the way, broadly speaking, double the amount of money that I can find when we talk about money for both revenue costs, you know, like paying people and investment, like building new assets in the economy. So we're talking about 92 billion of tax and over 100 billion of funding for investment. I mean, we really are talking megabucks here. This is 10% of the UK GDP, which is so big that clearly nobody is going to do all this overnight. But my point was, I wanted to offer the politicians choice, because they always sit in front of a journalist and you see them in the UK. They're sitting on Newsnight. They're on the Radio 4 Today programme, which is where they're all grilled. And, you know, both of these equivalent of RTE. And some journalist says to them, how are you going to pay for it? And they sit there looking completely dumb and A, not answering, I'll print the money, which they could do, and B, having no clue as to what extra tax they might find. But there's also, and I think this is just as important, particularly for the people who are going to be listening to this, I wanted to actually empower campaigners. Because I know so many campaigners who are campaigning on environment, on health, on education, on social care, you name it, we've got it. And I know lots and lots of those people. And every one of their campaigns says, well, we need to find 2.3 billion or whatever else. And the campaigns always die when the journalist again turns around and say, how are you going to pay for it? And they said, well, the government should pay for it. Yeah, but how are they going to pay for it? I don't know. So end of story. What I've done is provide, you know, if you like, a whole smorgasbord, if you're familiar with Norwegian culinary excitement, you know, their buffet is called a smorgasbord. Well, this is a whole literal choice of anything you want to find a way to offer an answer to that question, how are you going to pay for it? I want to empower people to answer the question. I have an answer to that.
Richard, you're a very clever guy. But in honesty, why are the politicians sitting there with no answers? You're not the only person who can figure this out. You're certainly out of the smorgasbord of 30. Somebody somewhere along the line has thought of five or six of them. Why don't politicians have this information?
Well, first of all, actually, thank you for saying I'm clever. That's very kind of you. Flattery will get you everywhere, Martin, and including a return visit next month, I suspect. So fine, we've booked that. Now, let's move on from the flattery. Has everybody worked this out? Nobody's done anything like this before. I've never seen a report like this in my whole 20 years of tax campaigning, and tax campaigning is only 20 years old. Nobody's tried to put something together like this before. And secondly, half these things are not being said. I mean, for example, at the moment, the big debate is, should we have a wealth tax? Now, you just heard me say, I want extra tax paid by people with high incomes and high wealth. And unsurprisingly, the two go pretty closely together. Again, like everything else, we know there are exceptions to rule. You know, the very poor granny living in the enormous house that she has had for 60 years. And so land rich, cash poor. But they can always be managed around. The truth is, high wealth and high income tend to go very closely together. So why don't I want a wealth tax? Simply because a wealth tax will take forever to put in place. The tax base that is available is actually much smaller than most people think. In the UK, we've got over 15 trillion of financial wealth, supposedly. But most of that is locked up in either pension funds or houses, people's homes. And they are both incredibly difficult to tax because they basically got tax incentives on them to encourage people to buy them or invest in them. Or they're in ISAs, which we call individual savings accounts, which are tax incentivized accounts. Over 80%, in fact, of the UK's wealth is tied up in something which is already tax incentivized. Really hard, therefore, to then go and slap a tax on it. So the government will end up, any government would end up with all sorts of knots tied around its opportunities to, you know, develop a reasonable tax policy. It goes for a wealth tax. And those who are claiming that wealth taxes are the answer are, in my opinion, I'm sorry to say, a bit naive, because they don't also understand that wealth taxes are immensely difficult to collect. How much is a racehorse worth? You know, if it's Shergar, it was worth a fortune. If it's, you know, Dobbin from down the road who runs in the 2 o'clock in the local point to point, not a lot. Dobbin's a liability. So, you know, how much is a racehorse worth? How long's a piece of string? Same with a piece of art, same with some more esoteric, you know, houses and everything else. These things will tie up the revenue authorities in knots forever trying to agree them. And next year, they'll have to start all over again. It's a very poor and inefficient way to collect money. I've gone for the lowest common denominator again, the low-hanging fruit, as you called it, Tony.
Richard, can I put it to you, though? You're not really avoiding a wealth tax and some of the things you're suggesting. So, for example, like the tax on financial services is a good idea of, and it is in a way, it's an indirect tax on wealth.
Yeah, of course it is. And that's what I'm doing. And what I'm trying to do is find ways in which I can collect money from wealth by proxy, in effect. So I'm not actually going to send you a bill of X percent on your wealth. I'm just going to find ways I can collect it in other ways. So on the income you've earned from wealth, or in the case of this VAT charge on financial services, and why don't we have a VAT charge on financial services? It's pretty absurd, isn't it? Who buys financial services? Let me tell you, it's not the poor. And I've taken into consideration the fact that in the UK, I'm not sure about the situation in Ireland. Do you have a tax on insurance premiums? I think you do. We do.
We have.
I thought you did.
We also have some of them that are, because we've got ones that, one is literally called the, what did he refer to as, Martin? The Quinn tax.
Where Quinn insurance went bust and we're all paying a levy for it.
And everybody else got an
additional
tax.
Everybody's paying
a
surplus for that.
Yeah.
But when we... Yeah, amazing, isn't it? We can raise tax to bail out private sector failure, but we can't raise tax for anything else. You know, welcome to the world of water companies in the UK, by the way. Different problem. But I reckon we could raise $8.7 billion by putting VAT on the financial services that at present aren't insurance, in effect. And that's things like pension consultancy. Well, who pays for pension consultancy if you're not already rich? Bank fees, particularly on arranging things like, you know, takeovers and mergers. I mean, surely they should be subject to VAT. All of these bizarre things which are exempt at the moment should be subject to VAT. It's a way of collecting tax.
I think it's a very good idea. And I think we have a phrase, I don't know if you use the same phrase over there, that there's more than one way to skin a cat.
Absolutely. And that's exactly, again, why there's 30 versions here. Nobody is going to do all 30 of the things I say. Yeah, I put forward a report knowing that some of them will never happen. That's okay. I don't mind. I don't care if you only use three. I mean, if Rachel Reeves has only used three of my big ideas, she could transform things. She could do that Green New Deal, which she hasn't done. Let's take a simple one. Let's take the first one on the list that I've got. When I pay into a pension... Mm-hmm. And although I'm an OAP, I'm still allowed to pay into a pension if I want to. And I'm a university professor and I earn enough money that I pay the higher rate of tax in the UK, the middle higher rate tax. That's 40% instead of the basic rate of tax. If I pay into a pension, I get tax relief on my pension contribution at 40%. So let's give a simple, straightforward example. Suppose I decided I'm going to put 10,000 quid into my pension. I'm not going to, but suppose I did. The state would pay £4,000 of that by giving me tax relief. But if a junior lecturer decided to put £10,000 into their pension scheme, extra contribution, they'd only get tax relief at 20%. So it would cost them £8,000 to put £10,000 in, whereas it cost me £6,000 to put £10,000 in. That's just a straightforward subsidy to the wealth. But let's put that in context. First of all, that costs $14.5 billion a year, that extra subsidy. And let's also put that into terms of what it means per person. On average, the top 10% of people in the UK get a subsidy of 8,500 quid, near enough per annum each, a year, for subsidies for money going into their pension funds. That's double the average claim for universal credit.
Yeah, so if everybody was at the marginal rate, Richard, you'd be literally taking in more or saving the state a multiple of what you said in around universal credit. Martin, do you remember one of the things, and I just wanted to point out, so the Irish listeners will remember this, the SSIAs, and Richard, you might remember the old SSIA. It was a Charlie McGreevy, Bertie Ahern, you know, throw in four quid, the government will give you one. And the thing that was always funny about the SSIA, you could put 250 quid a week, a month away into this thing, and then, you know, all the people who had money did the max immediately because it was a guaranteed return. But it was also a great vehicle for pensions because they said, oh, by the way, do it on a pension, you get 40%. and the pension didn't have a 5-year limit on it, you know. So the wealth makes wealth. But how do you then, here's the thing, here's the problem, Richard, how does this become politically palatable? Because you've mentioned the incoming, and I'm going to refer to them as the incoming government, and they are poor mouthing to beat the band already. You know, they've backed down from every single pledge that they've made has already been shelved, including the Green New Deal that they spoke about, because they're afraid to be told that they're going to spend spend money and have to increase taxes. How do you get that message through that it's actually not really increasing taxes? It's just sharing. It's actually sharing the burden in a much more equal way.
Well, let's be clear. You've hit on a real target with your last comment, because, of course, you could do all the 92 billion and you could seriously cut the taxes on those on low income. So we could just do this for redistribution without ever spending any more government money, just have the government redistribute the tax burden. So that's one of the opportunities. Look, I spent 20 minutes this morning listening to Rachel Reeves on both radio and television. That's 20 minutes of my life I won't get back again. But it was worthwhile, because I can tell you that what she said is, taxing wealthy people is not my priority. That's what she said live on air to a television presenter this morning, which is pretty staggering from a Labour Party shadow chancellor who, according to, you know, the best estimates, has got a 99% of chance of being our Chancellor of the Exchequer before the year is out. And she doesn't care about taxing wealth. Well, my answer to that is, look, you know, show me a brick wall and I'll hit my head against it. I have done for a long time. I've always hit my head against brick walls. And eventually the brick wall gives in, is my experience. You know, there's a bit of pain on the way. I'm not denying that. And the amount of time it takes is variable. But I've been involved in a lot of campaigns where I start off and reckon, well, we're talking about a 10-year time horizon. But until you begin to create the narratives, the dialogues, that better song to sing that we've talked about before on this blog, this podcast, you know, until we talk about that there is an alternative, we don't get change. So the purpose, again, of the Taxing Wealth Report here is to begin a debate about, is it possible to change the whole structure of tax in the UK? Is it possible to charge the wealthiest more because they're undertaxed and reduce the burdens on those who are on lowest income? And in the meantime, fund the Green New Deal, flood defences, whatever else it is we all need along the way.
I wouldn't have thought that it's a hard sell for, we'll say, old Labour to say, we're going to cut pension tax deals for the quite wealthy, and we're going to increase the lowest pension, state pension, in the EU by a couple of shekels. I wouldn't have thought that's a hard sell, Rich.
I mean, literally, if you cut the pension, the tax relief on the pension contributions for the best off, you could increase pensions for every single old age pensioner by over £1,000 straight
away. Now, you see, that's not a difficult
it's as simple as that.
Sell. That's
it's glaringly obvious, you'd have thought, isn't it? And actually, I do talks to constituency Labour parties in the UK. When I'm invited to talk to a constituency Labour party, they always get a letter from Labour head office these days saying you're not allowed to talk to Richard Murphy. Because apparently I'm an enemy of the Labour Party. Also.
Oh, we're enemies of the state. We're with you.
Yes, you know, so this is just one thing you have to sort of put up with. It's quite absurd that they get those letters, but people still invite me and I talk to them and they like this stuff. So the Labour Party membership like this. But what you have to face in the UK now, and you guys aren't entirely unaware of this problem, is that we have a conspiracy between the major parties to make sure that those who are anywhere vaguely on the left, from middle into real left, They haven't got anybody they can really vote for who's got a chance of power. And that's certainly what Labour is doing. It's trying to make damn sure that the left has no chance of getting near power. I don't think that is sustainable. I think we are beginning to see people so frustrated that the alternative narratives as to what is possible have to be created. But unless you have a story about how you can raise the money, any other alternative narrative is beyond hope.
You're hoping
so this story is
you're hoping they'll,
really important.
They'll divest Blairism. I don't know.
Well, can I put one thing to you that's in the report? Because most of the UK's councils are bankrupt, effectively, Richard. They're insolvent. Yeah. You're talking about reform there. Can we talk about this a little bit? Because this fascinates me. Because we've seen councils being blamed for, you know, the lack of resources when they've had their budgets slashed. They've no money to actually carry things. And now they're, you know, now there's schools that, you know, you have this dodgy concrete, this aerated concrete. We've seen all of these things. And they don't have the money to deal with it. And you have the likes of Rishi Sunak running around saying, oh, well, you know, they've bad mismanagement, as if changing the managers is somehow going to fix some of this. And then on the other side, you've Keir Starmer saying, this is terrible, but I'm not committing to any additional spending. So tell me about, particularly around the council reform that you're talking about, because it really interests me, because I think that is something that's the lack of a resource teacher in a school for a child who has special needs. That's all of those things.
Unfortunately, and I'm going to admit this, you've hit on the weaker section of the taxing wealth report. Because reforming council tax in the UK as a whole is really hard. Because fundamentally, the government has basically put limits on how much tax can be raised locally. It's created the council tax system. It's put limits on how much can be raised. We can reform perhaps within those constraints. We could make it more progressive within those constraints, considerably more progressive within those constraints. But would it, even if we were to change things, actually radically raise the amount of money available to local authorities? The answer is no. You'd have to introduce new taxes or devolve powers from central government to local government over some taxes to improve the situation. Now, we've got a slight model for that. We've got models of devolved taxation powers in Wales and Scotland, and every time they use them, they get slagged off by central government, and I have little doubt that Labour will be the same, because Labour has absolutely no love for the SNP, who are in power in Scotland, and frankly, it doesn't appear as though Keir Starmer's got any love for his own Labour administration in Wales, because they appear to be at loggerheads with each other already. Partly because Plaid are involved in that Welsh administration. It's a coalition which is anathema to Keir Starmer. So there's no sign at the moment that we have devolved any appetite to increase the amount of tax devolved. If you look at countries like Sweden, if you look at Finland, you know, the Nordic states, when they're successful models, 30 to 40% of tax is raised locally. But in the UK, nothing like that. And including in Scotland, where it's only income tax, it's less than 25%. And the parameters for difference, which Scotland's allowed to have with regard to income tax, are tiny. So we have this massively centralised model of government funding. And at the moment, that model also is inherently unfair, because they set a tax rate for what is called Band D houses, which are worth around, well, where I live, around £300,000, which are supposedly middle houses. And the A houses have to pay at least half of what the D houses do. And the top band houses, however much they're worth, 30 million, only pay double what the D houses do. So it's really unfair at the bottom, because those people who are living in the lowest valued houses are actually, you can guess, stretched to their limits already and way beyond, but are still paying council tax. Whilst at the top, you know, council tax is, you know, spare change. So we can change the banding, and we can change the number of empty properties that are going to be subject to tax, and we can change the rules on second properties and deal with the issue that, you know, the Airbnb boom in the UK is crazy. I heard recently about Scarborough in North Yorkshire. 2 years ago, it had 200 Airbnbs, and now it's got 1,000 Airbnbs. And that obviously is a problem with regard to coastal degradation, undermining of communities in holiday areas and God knows what else. And so we need to change that. But it still doesn't fundamentally change the fact that we have to allocate more money. from centre to local. And this is what George Osborne did. You know, Tony, just in 1 second before I let you jump in again.
Go ahead.
I know I can talk forever, but George Osborne basically devolved austerity to local authorities. He wanted to impose cuts, and he did it by saying they can't spend any more money. I can, but they can't. And he made them take the pain. The local politician took the pain. And that's still going on, and we've not corrected it. That failure has to be corrected, or we will carry on with the monstrous situation. 30 miles up the road from me, there's a hospital with 1,500 scaffold props in it because the roof is falling down.
Jesus Christ. It's funny how your poll tax sounds so like our property tax, and how your council sounds so like our council, except I think ours are even more devolved, Tony. Centralized.
I think absolutely. We know our local authorities basically have a power to come up with a central plan for 5 years, and that's basically
that's it.
But I think what I think is really interesting is you actually have touched on ways and means of how by moving bans, and indeed not just moving bans, but by actually looking at, say, dereliction and vacancy rates and things like that.
Oh yeah.
And we've seen how that has worked in places like, say, Amsterdam, for example, where you introduce Frank and Jude from Anish, the consultancy in Cork, and I don't say nice things about Cork very often, but they're brilliant on this. They talk about this in great detail, and they say you've two choices: you tax as much property as you can, a little amount, or you tax the outliers a heavy amount, and you incentivize them all back into use, and you make sure that you're getting the return and the bang for your buck, and you can address things like that. And with the stroke of a pen, we know in Ireland we could change things in terms of the problems that are happening with Airbnb. So I'm assuming it's similar in terms of the UK,
yeah,
because our model is very much based on your model.
Can I just mention one other thing? And I'll mention my friends at a think tank in Scotland called Commonweal. Not Commonwealth, Commonweal. And they've just produced a report on land value taxation. Now, I don't think land value taxation is particularly useful in England. I think it could be in Wales, and in Scotland it's really important, because Scotland is a flipping big country. It has a very large landmass, large parts of which are owned by some exceedingly wealthy people and are managed mainly to let them shoot grouse on the 12th of August each year. Yeah, this is leisure parkland, basically, for leisure shooting, and it has no other apparent benefit to society. If we were to change the system in those parts of the country where that is dominant, so we also brought into scope land used for leisure use, then we would definitely have a basis for land value taxation more broadly. It has a particular relevance to Scotland, and it would be highly relevant if Scotland was independent, and I would strongly recommend it to an independent Scottish government. But it's something harder for the rest of the UK, but nonetheless worth looking at. That, again, could bring more into use. So the idea of taxing more of the land and buildings which are sitting out of use, owned by those with wealth, who can literally let it sit there doing nothing, then that's a greater benefit. And I would increase the tax on an empty property after 5 years to 10 times the normal rate of tax. And that would begin to hurt.
Oh, you have to. We dereliction is actually social, is social bloody warfare, because it's especially in the midst of, like, we only see the reports in the UK, Richard, about the number of children now in living in poverty and deprivation. And it got so little attention. It just shows you that, unfortunately, there's almost been a normalization of this. And we've seen this now while we're recording, there's another Taoiseach is leaving and the new Taoiseach is coming in. And their legacies over since the last three of them, whether it be Enda Kenny, Leo Varadkar, and now Simon Harris, is an increase in child homelessness of 650%. And, you know, we just kind of, when it comes out on a monthly basis, people kind of say, oh, and was it not always like this? No, it wasn't. And nor should it have.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. The level of destitution, we don't even use the word poverty anymore. We can reasonably use the word destitution now in the UK, because we've gone beyond even relative and absolute poverty to something which is just, you know, grim beyond that. The children who literally turn up at school with no chance of having had a meal before they get there, and school is the only place where they'll get one, and things like that. That is just growing enormously. We're talking about literally, I think it is 3+ million people in the UK
it's
now
over
living
3 million,
in destitution.
Yes, yeah.
And it's, you know, and a third of those will be children because they're living in, you know, often with single mums, and it's absolutely staggering. And it's really profoundly worrying. But Rachel Reeves has no priority for taxing wealth. I wish to tell you that she really doesn't think that's important.
You know, history doesn't repeat, but it certainly echoes, Richard, and we all know.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, I am very much reminded of Marie Antoinette saying, "Let them eat cake." You know,
yeah.
At some stage, and as Tony said, these things get normalized. Well, they only get normalized for the class that's not affected. They're not normalized for the people who are affected.
And this is why we need to build these alternative narratives and stories all the time about the fact that we don't need to accept this nonsense, that actually we don't have to live with children in destitution. We could provide for them. We could meet the needs of everybody within our societies. Everybody could have a decent roof over their head. Everybody could have food. Everybody could have clothing. Everybody could have access to a mobile phone. Because actually, yeah, that's a real precondition of being able to take part in society now. And everything else. Yeah, but we can have these things.
But then do we go back to the report? And I think what's key to this is the idea, because we don't teach it properly, we don't talk about it properly, but it's something you've been key talking about for a couple of decades, and one of the people who championed the idea of tax justice. So,
yeah.
You know, we keep hearing about, you know, the tax avoidance and tax evasion, and whereas the Tax Justice Network will refer to illicit financial flows. This is tax justice is what you're talking about, and at the center of that, Richard, is, if you said a smorgasbord of ideas, my God, like, surely we should be able to pick out half a dozen and just see that under the guise of, let's try this tax justice idea.
Well, and you don't even have to do them to the full extent that I've suggested. I mean, one of the ideas I put forward is something called an investment income surcharge. Now, we had one of those. In fact, it was so popular that George Harrison wrote a song about it. He wrote a song called The Tax Man in 1968. And it was about the fact that he paid 98% tax, 83% income tax, which I wouldn't actually recommend, plus 15% investment income surcharge on unearned income. Because why did they charge tax on unearned income? Well, because the Labour Party back then, you wouldn't recognise it now, but the Labour Party back then thought that actually they should tax income from work less than income from wealth. Now we're doing the exact reverse, and that's what Labour wants to continue. But an investment income surcharge would be the equivalent of national insurance on investment income. Because one of the great causes of tax injustices in the UK, and people who work for a living in the UK pay a much higher overall rate of tax than do the people who live on interest and dividends and rents and capital gains and everything else, as was shown by the tax return of our dearly beloved leader, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, this year, who paid an overall rate of tax of just over 22%. Staggeringly, because most of his income was capital gains. If only we charged an investment income surcharge on this of 15%, they would then have to pay the equivalent of national insurance. We would create a more level playing field. But, oh, you would think that the heavens would fall down, the walls will collapse, the whole of the entrepreneurial spirit of the world will fail.
But this is the barrier you're going to come up against again,
of course it is.
Again. You're going to have rich people telling you how hard it is for them to become richer and how you're wrong.
Well, look, I'll give you an example. Tony mentioned I had been on Bloomberg just literally before I came here, which is very nice of Bloomberg to invite me on. And I'm sorry, guys, I delayed you by half an hour while I did it.
Well, I know you hate your guests being late. We know. And Martin was late as well, folks, just for the benefit of everybody.
I still feel the knockback, Richard. I still feel it.
But what did Bloomberg ask me when they said, oh, you're picking on small business? Because one of the things I'm saying is I want the revenue to reopen local tax offices in the UK. We've only got 14. The nearest tax office to Cornwall is in Bristol. It's a 2.5-hour drive away. The nearest tax office to the Shetland Islands is in Edinburgh. It's 400 miles away. Yeah, this is ludicrous. The nearest tax office to the port of Felixstowe, where there's a customs officer based, is in Nottingham. It's 2.5 hours away. I mean, we literally don't have people on the ground to actually find out what's going on anymore. When I started as an accountant, there were local tax officers. They knew who were the dodgy accountants. They knew who were the good accountants. They knew where the dodgy people were, what businesses they were running, because they lived in the community. They listened out, etc. I've said, just invest in doing that and collect more money. Now, Bloomberg's reaction was, oh, no politician will do this. That's an anti-business policy. I said, hang on a minute. That's a really, really pro-business policy, because supporting honest businesses who want to pay their taxes, who want to actually employ people and pay over the PAYE on it, who want to be able to afford the apprentices, which kind of pay for out of the tax system because you get a subsidy for apprentices and so on. Now, that's really important because that's the investment program that you want. But if they're all being undermined by the cheats next door who don't pay any tax at all, then all the small business community will become criminogenic and you won't have any growth whatsoever. And this is evidenced around the world. Tax systems work, you get growth. Tax systems don't work, you don't get growth. It's really pretty much as straightforward as that. Put that to Bloomberg, that collecting tax is a really strong pro-business policy, and you could see the heads being scratched really heavily. What do you mean? Paying tax is a pro-business policy. But it is. It's glaringly, obviously pro-business. Even Milton Friedman said everybody should comply with the rules. I'm getting excited now. I found a positive thing to say about Milton Friedman, and that doesn't happen very often.
You've jumped the hedge and left
it. We're Arian Rand coming next. Wait, this quote.
But Martin, I need to bring this again. I know from an Irish perspective, just think about how our new Taoiseach's incoming speech, he talked about bringing supports for businesses, including a pause on sick pay, which was a real, and it was reported like that. And I just thought, this is very interesting. What he's effectively saying is, even though we're at full employment, even though in retail and hospitality, we've seen an increase in employment, even though we're paying effectively the lowest sort of wage rates in any of the types of work that are being out there, they want to pause the benefits that they might get in terms of availability of sick pay should you be sick. And I thought, wow, that, Richard, is a funny way of framing it. And because it's actually anti-worker, it's anti-tax collection, it's anti an improvement in people's disposable incomes, and it's actually a regressive step. So yeah, it's much to what you're saying about let's not let the guys away with, you know, just because they can put people on, you know, 3 day weeks and bring them in and hire, say, three people on this rather than actually pay one person a decent wage. We should be able to cut down on that type of crap, because work should be valued and work should be paid. And I don't want revenue commissioners combing the streets everywhere, but you know, you're right. There should be some sort of Constantine Gordievsky says it all the time. Says it's more effective. You can write as many economic papers as he wants, but it's more effective walking down his main street and looking at the shop windows, looking at are they busy? Are people carrying goods? You know, are their heads up? Are they actually, you know, do they look like they're happy? Do they look like they're actually, you know, somehow
the economics of walking about, as Danny Blanche Flower and I call it.
Yeah. And you say it all the time about the bus drive that you can see as you come through a certain part of London. You can see the socioeconomic classes and how the economy is going. Yeah. So what we're talking about here is tax justice, and ultimately making. But again, we keep coming back to it. How do you sell that to the public, particularly when you have a Tory party who have no interest in it, and their only interest is actually making sure they tell everybody that if you let Labour in, they're just gonna blow the economy that's already a disaster.
Well, actually, I did a tweet this morning when I was listening to Rachel Reeves on the radio. And she was saying, well, I've had to look at collecting more tax from the tax gap, you know, this unpaid tax, because the Tories have stolen my idea to close the domicile rule and various other things. Yeah, okay. So actually, you weren't really bothered about unpaid tax until the Tories took away your domicile rule thing. You really don't care very much at all about this. You just had to find a number you could slot into your spreadsheet to supposedly balance the books. You don't really care whether you collect this money or not, but it does suit your short-term purpose to actually say, this number balances my equation. And it sort of explained her own indifference. And it comes down to a simple fact. We have politicians who just don't give a fig about what the state can do for people. And tax isn't really, at the end of the day, about raising money. And that sounds really bizarre to most people I know, because the state can create money to spend, and we know it can because it's obviously ran massive deficits during COVID periods and global financial crises and God knows what else. And we're all told we have to repay back that money, but that's, well, let's provide a technical response to that. That's bollocks. You don't have to repay that money back. It's money, and you can't repay money except with money, and therefore it doesn't even work. So let's ignore that, and let's talk about what tax really does. Tax has the power to redistribute. Tax has the power to enable. Tax has the power to let you run an industrial policy. Tax is part of your social policy because it's all about how you help people. Tax is about choosing your future because it can be used to fund a Green New Deal, carbon, and God knows what else. Tax is actually very much more than about simply collecting money. Tax is about how you shape the society you live in. But these politicians don't, A, want a fair society, and B, don't want to think about their ability to manage the society that we live in, because C, they're too small-minded to have a vision. They don't have a vision. They think the market's got a vision. And that's its job, is to work out what we're going to do, not theirs. And whilst we have, you know, absolutely impoverished intellectual idiots running politics, and that's what we are faced with most of the time, who really do not believe in the job that they're so desperate to have. Where do we go? That's the real question you're putting to me. And my answer is, as ever, we're sort of, let's go back to Gramsci, you know, we're waiting for the new to be born here. And that's the problem we're facing. The old is dying. I mean, frankly, there isn't anybody who I meet who is inspired by Labour in the UK any more than I know that there's anybody who's going to be desperately inspired, frankly, I suspect, in Ireland by Simon Harris. If I'm honest, I don't think he's going to set the world alight with excitement. I can watch you two guys, for the benefit of the listeners, nodding in agreement. So I think I hit the right button there. And the point is that these people are desperately uninspired. They're visionless. We need to change the rules of the game so we have people who believe in the power of the state to do good, so we can meet the needs of people and only then worry about meeting the wants of people. Now, we've all got wants. I would love them all to be met as well, but we know that there's a finite world. But if we don't meet the needs of people, we have people in poverty, and that offends me, and we can use tax to put that right. And again, at the core of the Tax and Wealth Report is my belief in society.
I think we're going to wrap it on that, Richard. And I'm going to give you full credit for that. That was a great monologue. Thank you very much for that, Tony.
Thank
I'm going
you.
To clip that and turn that into the piece
there. We already... We've gotten our title of the podcast is definitely going to be you have to meet their needs before you meet their wants. It's brilliantly put. Yeah. So, Richard,
little anecdote just to finish it up. Revenue in Ireland, and the last time they were in the Public Accounts Committee, they were asked about how do they keep a track on things, and part of it is they monitor social media. It's a true story, and that only just happened. I swear to God, that only just happened within the last couple of weeks. And the last thing.
Well, can I tell you?
Go.
Rachel Reeves follows me on Twitter. But even more surprising to me was I actually looked at the HM Revenue and Customs Twitter account here. And they only follow 120 people in the whole of the UK.
Oh, they have meetings about me, the Irish Revenue.
are you one of them, Richard? Come on.
I'm honest to God, Tony has... Tony has documents that show that the Irish Revenue Commissioners discussed this podcast.
Yeah, which is terrifying when you think about it. But look, we will leave it there. Thank you so much, Richard Murphy, yet again. We will have a link to the full report. There is a summary, folks. You don't have to read the whole, like, 700.
No, you have to read the whole thing. And I will endeavor to read the whole thing, unlike Tony.
Don't. You can. This is genuinely meant to be picked between the choices. The choices are laid out. Read the ones that are interesting. You won't be interested in them all. That's fine.
Oh, no. Thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And we will be back with you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin. Martin and Tony. Speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe. subscribe now on Patreon.